Hello, and thank you for tuning in to New Jersey Revolution Radio on the web at www.njrevolutionradio.com. Tonight, we're going to take you to the event that we sponsored in Montclair last Monday. The main sponsors of the event were the U.S. Peace Council, as well as Jewish Voice for Peace and Veterans for Peace. So we were really proud to be a part of this coalition in bringing this very important speaker to New Jersey. And first, we will hear our comrade Baham Azad from the U.S. Peace Council making the introduction of Aida Tuma Slimin. Thank you very much, everybody, for tuning in to New Jersey Revolution Radio. Thank you very
much. Oh, that's one. I thought you were doing it. Now, my second task, the main task, I would like to introduce, I'm honored to introduce to you Aida Tuma Slimin. She is a member of the Israeli Parliament Knesset from the Joint List Hadash, which is also Democratic Front for Peace and Equality. That's the translation of the name. She is also the chairwoman of the Knesset's Standing Committee on the Status of Women and Gender Equality, which makes her the first Palestinian member of Israeli Knesset to hold such a position in Israel. From 2011 to 2015, she was the chief editor of Al Ittihad, the only and largest Arab newspaper published in Israel, and is also co-founder and member of International Women Commission for Just Peace, Israel-Palestine. Aida Tuma is currently a member of the Political Bureau and the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Israel. And she is also the president of the Peace and Solidarity Committee in Israel, which is a member of the World Peace Council, and a dedicated peace and justice activist and a persistent defender of women and human rights, who was nominated for Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. Thank you very much, Aida. I'm honored to invite you.
Thank you. Good evening. Allow me first really to thank the people who got me into this challenging, not trouble, challenging, in my opinion, and exciting tour. The U.S. Peace Council, of course, and the whole co-sponsors, the chapters of the U.S. Peace Council, and in this occasion, the Green Party and the Jewish Voice for Peace. I'm really honored to be asked to do this tour because that's true. We are under a lot of stress these days back home, and we are needed mainly to be there with our own people, trying to struggle for an important cause, which I will relate to later. But also being away sometimes for 10 days, looking from a different perspective about our situation, listening to people, and knowing that there are in the world and here in this situation in the United States of America, people who really care, people who have their own opinion and interest in what's happening back home in Israel, and of course in Palestine, in occupied Palestine. Understanding that solidarity is a very important component in any struggle. You can feel that any struggle is difficult, but when you know that there are people who are solidarizing, who are willing to be part of this struggle, it makes it always easier. And it makes it also hopeful when dark days are controlling our lives and we feel one day after another that we are losing hope. It's always good to be with good company, with people who feel and think the same way and share the same values. So thank you for having me. Thank you for having this opportunity. When we started planning this tour, and it was like 4 or 5 months ago, we thought that we will be focusing in this tour on the developments that are happening on the Palestinian side of the equation, and trying to understand how also the connection between what's happening here in the United States of America is affecting our reality and our situation back as citizens of Israel, as also Palestinians, because I am myself a Palestinian. I'm citizen of Israel, but I belong to my own people as a Palestinian, and I feel all the suffering that mainly the Palestinians are going through, but also the Israeli Jewish citizens who are paying the price for being part of a state that is controlled by fanatics, in my opinion, very right-wing powers who are leading the two people into continuous bloodshedding. We thought we are going to focus on this, especially after United States administration, with the leadership of Mr. Trump, decided to move the embassy, the American embassy, from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. That was maybe for certain parts of the world another administrative decision to be taken, and they are only moving the embassy from one city to another. It wasn't like this, and whoever understands the reality on the ground understands that this is a shift, a political shift, or at least political declaration that is not bringing a lot of hope or a lot of understanding how things should be led in Israel and in Palestine. Taking the decision to move the embassy into Jerusalem, while Jerusalem is celebrated by Israel as a unified city, while Israel is insisting, the government, the Israeli government, the Netanyahu's government, is insisting that the unified Jerusalem, which means East-occupied Jerusalem and Jerusalem, is unified into one city, is going to continue to be the eternal, how it is called, the eternal capital of Israel, is another sign of legalizing what is not legal, legalizing the continuous occupation, legalizing a decision and a law in Israel that is violating the international agreements and the international recognition of East Jerusalem as an occupied territory. And later on started the marches, the return march in Gaza, and of course all the killing that is happening on the borders of Gaza. We thought that we are going also to focus on this in this tour, because this march that has been, that started in March and is continuing till today. Even last Friday, the demonstrations has continued, was erupted many times by killing, by Palestinians losing their life. And actually, although it is called the Return March, in order to declare that the Gazan people are still insisting that they want their freedom and liberation, and they want to practice the international right that was given to the refugees to return to their homeland, it was also a cry. It was also an attempt to bring the attention of the world to the crisis, to the humanitarian crisis that is happening inside Gaza. Gaza today is in a situation where 95% of the water in Gaza is not for humanitarian use. In 2020, 100% of the water is not going to be good to be used by human beings. Electricity is actually arriving to the homes of Gaza 4 hours a day. That might be for some people a fact, but when you think about how you can run your life and how you can run hospitals and how you can run institutions when you get electricity only 4 hours a day, then you understand what we are talking about. When we think about the young people in Gaza who have one dream, maybe, to travel to a different country in order to resume their studies, and they are not allowed to leave Gaza in any way. In the last few months, I've been dealing almost on an everyday basis of cases of women who have breast cancer in Gaza, who need to be treated in hospitals, either in the West Bank or in Israel itself, because there is no treatment for them inside Gaza, are denied the authorization or the permit to enter and to get their treatment. Almost on every day basis, I'm dealing with these cases. These cases are women, are families, have names and have children, and you have to look straight in their eyes and to try to help in order to get that treatment. Last week, it was declared that the chemical therapy for different kinds of cancer that was available in the Palestinian hospitals in Gaza, in the Gazan hospitals, have vanished. And they stopped giving chemical therapy to the people who have cancer in Gaza. This is the situation. So when people are marching to the borders, and they know they might not return, not to their homeland, but return to that house in Gaza because they might be killed in the borders. People do not do that unless they feel that they have nothing to lose and they want to fight for a better life. This is the situation in Gaza. Of course, the situation in the West Bank is also bad. But we decided eventually to speak about not the everyday life. I decided to speak to you today about how political decisions, how legislation processes and laws can deepen even the misery and the suffering in the everyday life. Just 1 month ago, the Knesset, 1 hour before finishing the summer session and going on a recess of 2.5 months, voted on the so-called basic law. It is a basic law, and for those who do not know what is a basic law is the group of basic laws are supposed to be the constitution in the future. Israel is a very weird state in many meanings. One of them that there is no constitution till now. After 70 years, the state doesn't have a constitution. We have a group of basic laws. The new one of them is the basic law, Israel, the nation state law of the Jewish people. This law that we voted on in the last day, as I told you, at 5 o'clock in the morning, after very long debates, is not a new law that is brought to the Knesset. This law has been promoted in the Knesset by different versions since 2011 till today. 7 years, this law is coming and being taken out from the Knesset debates in different versions, but the last version that was voted on, in my opinion, is very much related not only to the misery of everyday life, but for the future of the conflict, of the continuous occupation of the Palestinian state. This law is meant to define what is the state of Israel. It is supposed to be an internal issue. It's supposed to be something that is very important, mainly to the citizens of Israel. But the way it is written, the way the articles are put here actually move it from only an internal Israeli issue to an, in my opinion, an international matter that everybody needs to study it, read it, and understand that the implications of this law are not only implications for the citizens of Israel, but implications for the future of the Middle East in general. Why I'm saying this? Because if you read the law itself, it starts with two words. The law that is supposed to define the state of Israel starts with the two words in the first article, the land of Israel. When we are talking about state of Israel, defining the state of Israel, and using the land of Israel, I don't know how much you know, but this is a kind of a biblical and later on adopted terminology by Zionism. Land of Israel means it extends not only for the borders of 1948, the borders of Israel, but it extends to what is called the land between the sea and the river. And of course, there is a debate, what river? Is it the Jordanian River or is it the river in Iraq, Dijla al-Furat? So it can extend till Iraq. This is the land of Israel. Using this terminology in a law that defines Israel as a state, in my opinion, is not a mistake. It is not by chance. It is meant to mix between the two things and to keep ambiguous feeling about what is Israel. Taking into consideration that this law defines very well the flag, who are the people who are citizens of Israel, this state is meant for any, for whom, the anthem, the language, it's all there, very well defined inside that law, except one thing. The borders of the state of Israel are not defined in this law. And by the way, it's not defined in any law in Israel. So in a law that is using land of Israel, and on the other hand, not defining the borders of Israel, that leaves us with a feeling that this very right-wing government that is embracing, actually, the settlers, it's the major or the most prominent ministers in Netanyahu's government are the representatives of the party who is representing mainly the settlers in the West Bank, which are the education ministry, the Ministry of Justice, but I call it Ministry of Law because there is no justice in that, and the Ministry of the Negev. These are ministers who are coming from the Jewish Home Party, which is the party that is representing the settlers. So when you are using the Israel land and when you are talking about the state of Israel, actually this government means by this law to say that, or actually not to say, to put a fact that there is not going to be a Palestinian state. The Palestinian people are denied by this law the right of self-determination, because one of the articles in that law says very clearly that the right of self-determination is only and solely given to the Jewish people in Israel. What is said by that, what is not said, is that the right of self-determination is not given to the Palestinian people. And if we are talking about the land of Israel, then it includes the Palestinians under occupation in the 1967 territories. Of course, another article is talking about Jerusalem, united Jerusalem, as the capital of Israel, as the eternal capital of Israel, part of the so-called united, which is a big lie. Jerusalem is not united. Jerusalem is two cities, and it's run, the occupied territory of East Jerusalem is run by a municipality, Israeli municipality, but that doesn't mean, even by walking in the city, you can understand that this is not a one city, that there are two people living in the same place, and of course there are settlers living inside the old city of Jerusalem, and there are more and more settlements added in order to change the demography and geography of Jerusalem. But still, if the Israeli government had to take a decision only 1 month or 2 months ago to dedicate 100 billion shekel, which you have to calculate it in dollars, in order to Israelize Jerusalem. That's how it was the decision, to Israelize Jerusalem. If you need to put that amount of money to Israelize something, it means it's not Israeli. It is, that's what it means. And if the government have to take that decision, they understand very well that they want to continue to occupy Jerusalem. This is the main political statement that is coming out of this law, out of that decision, governmental decision. So if this is the situation, and if we are talking about a situation where the Palestinian people are deprived of their right of self-determination, the borders are open, we are talking about the land of Israel, and we are talking about Jerusalem, that's a declaration that fits very well the electoral promise that Netanyahu gave 1 day before the last election. 1 day before the last election, 2015, Netanyahu promised, I will put all my efforts to avoid the establishment of the Palestinian state. He said that for the first time, because as you know, toward the international community, it is always said that Netanyahu and his extreme right-wing government are supporting a two-state solution. For the first time, Netanyahu told the truth, and actually not only the first time, maybe one of the very rare times, that he spoke the truth, and he said that he will put all the efforts to avoid establishing a Palestinian state, and here comes this law, after the step was taken by the U.S. administration of moving the embassy, this law is almost declaration of attempts to bury the two-state solution. So, as I said in the beginning, this law is mixing between the internal issue of defining the state toward its citizens and the external issue of an international interest of solving the problem and ending the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian land. But still, this law falls under the absolute prohibitions of the international law. And it is in big contradiction, because when you, by the international law, in order to have a constitution, and as I say, the basic law, and this basic law is the main pillar in the future constitution of Israel, you have to have two conditions. You have to have the consent of the people, and you have to guarantee the equality of treatment to all the citizens of the or the people of any state. These two conditions are not existing in this law, because consent there is no, for sure, even by reading the results of the voting of the Knesset. 62 members of the Knesset voted for this law, and 55 out of 120 voted against, and two abstained. So it's almost 51% supported that law, and 49 were against that law. So consent there is no. Discussions and debates or even trying to examine what is the general public opinion was not made. The second condition that is talking about equal treatment between the different groups or the people who are living in a state also is not existing in this law. You know, this law, one of the biggest debates around this law was that there is no, the word equality is not mentioned in all this law. You can go through the different articles. The two missing words from this law is democracy and equality. No mention for those two words in that basic law. Actually, the old definition that the law that defined Israel as a Jewish added democratic. It was Jewish and democratic. This basic law that is beyond and above any law that exists legally in Israel have skipped democracy and equality from it. There is no equal treatment by this law. Nevertheless, it's not only that it's not mentioning equality. It is giving a superior status to one group in the Israeli society, among the citizens of Israel, comparing to another group, which we will mention later, the Palestinian citizens of Israel. The Jewish citizens of Israel, the Jews, and even the Jews all over the world, have a superior status when we are talking about the citizens of Israel. It is very clear throughout the different articles when it says that the state of Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people in which it realizes its natural, cultural, religious, and historical right of self-determination. I say the exercise of the right to national self-determination in the state of Israel is unique to the Jewish people, but also, it is said in an article very clearly that the state views the development of Jewish settlement as a national value and shall act to encourage and promote its establishment and strengthening. Meaning that when there is, you know, a long debate has existed in the past, can a state that is defined for a certain group like Jewish state can be democratic? And when there is a contradiction between democratic values and not even values, democratic practices, and the fact of preferring one group, Jewish group, what will control, what will be chosen, the democratic practices, the democratic values, or the identity of being a Jewish state? And the claim was always in Israel that there is a balance that is kept between Jewish and democratic, and there is a way to exist in such a way. I think that the government, the current government, the right-wing, extreme right-wing government and its coalition has declared by this law that we are ending this debate. There is no need to debate anymore about contradiction between Jewish and democratic, because we are choosing the Jewish over the democracy. The fact that democracy is not, or democratic is not mentioned in the law, this is one statement. The other, emphasizing the superiority of the Jewishness of the state, I think, and the Jewish people, is another statement in this matter. So till now, we discovered that this law is first of all colonial, because it is intended to maintain the occupation and to close the door eventually in front of establishing a Palestinian state. It is anti-democratic law, And in my opinion, it is establishing for an apartheid regime in Israel officially. Now, many people will claim, and I know even among the Palestinian community inside Israel, my community, that will be affected very badly by this law, claim that what is in you? You know, people say 70 years we have been suffering from discrimination, from policies that are oppressing us as a national minority inside Israel, that is not giving us our rights, that is confiscating our lands, demolishing our houses, removing villages and displacing people. Budgets are not equal, education system is not equal, so what? What is new about this law? Think, first of all, this law is not mentioning 20% of the citizens of the state. A state that is defining itself is not including 20% of the citizens. The Palestinian citizens of Israel are the absentees in this law. They are not mentioned at all. We are not there. The state or this law is ignoring our existence and saying very clearly that we are not equal citizens, because there are citizens who are more privileged. That's why I'm saying it is a kind of an apartheid law, because it is giving superiority and segregating and making different levels of citizenship. There are, from now on, at least in the past, we could claim for equality because we were equal citizens. Today, it's very clear by this law that there are two kinds of citizenship. Citizenship for the Jews, even those who choose to be living abroad, living in different other countries, they have more privileges than the citizens, Palestinian citizens who are living, and they are, I don't know, second degree citizens or what kind of citizenship that we will learn through the process, it looks like. The horrible thing about this law that it changed the equation and the norms. The regular norm was equality. And the discrimination was supposed to be the abnormal situation or the extraordinary situation that you can claim to change. By this law, the norm is discrimination. The norm is going to be discrimination. If we could in the past oppose any policies that were practiced of discrimination by different means, either by, you know, masses moving and demonstrations, if by going to the Supreme Court and claiming for equality, or by our political activities inside the parliament or trying to promote laws for equality, that was the situation till today. From now on, the discrimination is the normal situation, and I'm afraid that even if there will be a normal human being appointed to be a minister back home and he wants to practice equality, that there will be right-wing activists or organizations or even politicians who will go against him, even to the Supreme Court, to say, no, you cannot practice equality. Because by this law, you have to prefer the Jewish, at least localities and settlements. And of course, when we are talking about giving priority to Jewish settlements and using the word, I'm using exactly the official translation, so that it's the official translation from the Ministry of Law, and I'm asking myself why would they call them settlements when in the whole world, settlements is usually used for the settlements or colonies that are built in the West Bank. It looks like the mixture of terminology is not by chance also. Because when they are talking about settlements, it can be also that they are going to give a better status to the settlements in the occupied territories. Someone can go to the Supreme Court and claim that by this basic law, you cannot practice equal measures. At the contrary, you are obliged as a minister to practice what is written in the basic law, which is preferring the Jewish settlements. When we are talking about preferring Jewish settlements, it's not only by building settlements. It's also budgets for development. It's also budgets for education. It's budgets for infrastructure. It's adding to your area that can be used by the same settlement lands, etc., etc. They can confiscate now lands, continue to confiscate now legally, totally, not by practice, confiscate from the Arab villages and give to Jewish settlements because it is a national value to develop the Jewish settlements. So it is a discriminatory law. It is an illegal law by the international law. It is a colonial law, but yet it is a basic law. It is kind of a constitutional law. When we are talking about a basic law, one of the dangerous sides of it, that from that law and the interpretation of that law, we can see now a wave of new laws brought to the Knesset with the same spirit of this law, with the same idea of the law. So we are expecting when we go back to the Knesset in mid of October, we're going to face more new laws that are a kind of going under the umbrella of this law. And it will be more discriminatory, it will be more deepening what I call the apartheid regime that is starting now to act inside Israel officially this time. One of the interesting things that happened also by this law is that Arabic was till the day, till month ago, an official language in Israel, beside the Hebrew. And there was a huge struggle done, and my faction in the Knesset led in the last 3 years since we are elected to have a special day in the Knesset every year for the Arabic language. And we managed to convince the Speaker of the House to have a simultaneous translation in the plenary only for that day. Don't dream, it's not for the whole year, but for that day. And we saw that as an important step because we believe that getting used to hear the language is one step in Israel. You know, we are, as Palestinian citizens of Israel, obliged to learn Arabic, Hebrew, English. The Jewish children are obliged to learn Hebrew and English. Arabic, they can choose to learn. And usually if they choose, and there are very few who choose to learn Arabic, they teach them the spoken or a dialect of the Arabic and not the proper Arabic that we use in literature and in writing and etc. So usually after they finish school, they almost don't know really Arabic. The only ones who really know Arabic among the Jews, even those who came from Mizrahi Arab countries in the past, the new generations are not that much knowing Arabic. The excellent Jewish speakers of Arabic usually are those who are working for the Shabak. And that's why we say there are three different Arabic in Israel. The Arabic that we know, the Arabic that is taught in the Jewish schools, and the Arabic that is taught for the Shabak people. Security, Shabak is internal security service. Sorry, you know the Mossad, you don't know the Shabak. The Mossad is the intelligence international working. Shabak is security services inside Israel. By this law, Arabic is decreased from an official language into a language with a special status. And please don't ask me what does it mean, because nobody could explain that. What does it mean, a special status for a language? Because what is happening now, somebody claims that there wasn't any Israeli law that says that Arabic is an official language. And it's as if true, there wasn't any law legislated in Israel saying specifically that Arabic is an official language. But there is a law that is adopting a Turkish law that existed before that organized a lot of things, including personal status issues, religious matters, etc. And it says specifically that there are three official languages: English, Hebrew, Arabic. And when, after the British Mandate and establishing Israel, they quit English as an official language. So there are two official languages. And that's how we build all of our struggle, going to the Supreme Court, asking the ministries to develop also all their forms in Arabic, asking the courts to have testimonies in Arabic and to give translation to anybody who want to use Arabic in the courts. All of this can vanish in one day now. And a good example of that, that one of our MKs from my party had to resign because of a rotation inside the list. And he introduced his resignation on the 8th of August this month to the Speaker of the House, written in Arabic. We wanted to know how this special status, does it include resignations in Arabic or only in Hebrew? We wanted to understand what are the limits of the special status. And of course, the Speaker of the House did not agree to sign this resignation, and he said he will never sign it. It's not written in Hebrew. After it went out to the media, after all the noise that happened, he got, it looks like a legal advice, and he declared that he couldn't sign it because he couldn't read it, and he does not understand what is written there. So he sent it to translation, and then he signed it. Why I'm saying this? Because this can happen now in any formal institution or any ministry or any office, that an Arab person can go there and want to have the services in Arabic, and nobody knows, and nobody can tell the office you have to deliver in Arabic. This is the new situation. Now, someone will say, what's wrong? I mean, there is one official language. It's the Jewish state. It should be Hebrew. I think Arabic is a language, but it's not only an instrumental, like any language. It's not only instrumental. When you are part of a national minority and you understand that language is also a kind of survival for the group, because it is reflecting the culture, it is reflecting the knowledge, it is reflecting the relations between people. Language is not only an instrument. And when you want to keep your identity, you want to keep also your language. It is also part of the narrative. This law, what is dangerous about this law, that it is erasing the other narrative. It is speaking only about the Jewish narrative or the Zionist narrative. It is not talking about, it is not the narrative that people who didn't have a land coming to a land that have no people. No, there were people and there are people on that land, and you cannot erase their narrative. And you know what? Erasing a language as it is official, it's not going to erase the culture or the people or the narrative of them. But this is how the extreme right wing government think that putting facts on the ground like they did with the settlements, they can put this law as a fact. And you know what? We decided that we fought against this law. We tried our best to avoid it, and we managed to convince 55 members of the parliament to vote against it. But the same day that this law was passed, we declared that it is the same day when the struggle to abolish this law has started. We declared that there is no coexistence with this law. We will not coexist with this law because it is all what I mentioned till now. It is colonial, it is apartheid components, it is anti-democratic, it is trying to erase a whole narrative and people rights from this country, and that's why we are leading a struggle. If you have asked me 10 days ago how I feel, you would have heard, which is something that a lot of people never heard from me, you would have heard a lot of depression and despair. And it is known that usually I'm more optimistic because I felt like it is a real shift in our struggle for the rights of the Palestinian people in general, for the rights of the Jewish Israelis and Arab who are citizens of Israel, Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, to live in a normal democratic situation. But last Saturday, not 2 days ago or 3 days, excuse me, the jet lag is not doing well with me. But the Saturday before I came here, on the 11th of August, something huge happened in Israel. There were 60,000 Jews and Arabs marching in Tel Aviv under a main slogan to abolish the law of nation states. It has been more than 10 years that such a wonderful thing of Jews and Arabs marching under one slogan in Tel Aviv happened. And it happened last Saturday. And from that point, we understood that there is a real hope. I believe, usually, that if you have a target, and it is a justful target and goal, you can really struggle for it, and eventually it happens. Some people think that we are crazy, that we are raising this slogan, and there is no way that it's going to happen. Because part of the 55 who voted against this law actually do not agree with us in all the analysis that I said before. And adding two words of equality and democracy to the law, it might have led them to vote for that law. So it is not so easy. to make or to convince to change that law. It's going to be a long-term struggle, and it's going to be very difficult. But something for sure, that this law was meant to segregate between Jews and Arabs, and to make Jews superior to Arabs, Palestinians in Israel. But the struggle for this law should be the opposite, should be bringing Jews and Arabs who believe in democracy and who want peace, and to segregate them from the anti-democratic, extremist, fanatic, right-wing people in Israel. So this is what should happen. And we insist that this is what is going to happen. In 1948, when Nakba happened, and at the same time the establishment of the State of Israel, my people, my parents, lived under military rule in Israel. And if you heard about the checkpoints and how difficult it was, that was the situation with the Palestinian villages inside Israel. In order to move from one village to another, you needed to go to the officer, military officer, and try to get a permit to go to the next village. If you had a land that you want to aggregate outside the village, the same. Every movement, every right of self-expression or political organizing had to go through that and was forbidden at that point. When my comrades, when the people, the leaders of my party at that time spoke about abolishing the military rule, everybody thought that they were crazy. And nobody believed that it will happen. And it happened. In 1965, the military rule inside Israel was removed from the Palestinian minority. That's why I believe that people can change situation. And people have to struggle in order to change this situation. And I'm promising you, we will continue to struggle to abolish this law. But we need you in this struggle. We need you to echo our voices here in the United States. I know you have a lot on your plate to deal with. I know that, and I can see when I'm speaking that you understand very well what I'm talking about, because you are somehow going through lately very similar policies. And it's not by chance that people get to be friends. It looks like there are a lot of similarities between how this country is governed and how my country is governed. And there are similarities in the practices and in the ideology and in the policies. Because for many years, Israel was a good servant of the interests of those who governed your country, of the United States of America, in our region, and was the best ally, not for the benefit of the people in Israel or the benefit of the people in the United States of America, but for the benefit of different groups who are ruling. That's why I believe, as I started in the beginning, to be away for 10 days, sometimes it's good to look at things from away, but also to connect to people who understand what we are talking about and to find ways to solidarize each with each other. And thank you for listening.
That was Aida Tuma Sliman from the Israeli Knesset speaking in Montclair at an event co-sponsored by New Jersey Revolution Radio. Here are her remarks after some questions were asked by the audience.
By the fact, some people tell us, but you are a member of the Knesset and you can elect and you can be elected. and you are represented, and this is democracy. This is not the democracy we are talking about. Democracy is not only the liberal way of being able to vote and being able to, which is not guaranteed also. I'm telling you, my feeling that this is not going to be guaranteed forever, because you remember what has been said in the last election, and the same day, Netanyahu went out and said, come and risk the situation. The Arabs are coming in groups to vote in buses, which means he delegitimized the most taken for granted action for any citizen is to vote. Probably you have here campaigns to make people vote. You are begging people to vote, because I know the percentages of voters are not very high in your country. So back home, people treat our voting as a Palestinian minority as if it's a terrorist attack. That people, you know, you need to grab your weapon and go out to defend the country. The Arabs are voting. So if this is the kind of discourse and way of thinking of those who are in the government, I'm not sure that we will be able to continue. Another thing, as an Arab MK, you know, the last 3 years, there was another law that was legislated. It's the suspension law, which means members of Knesset can start a process to suspend and to get rid of one of the MKs and to be kicked out of the Knesset, to be fired. You know, we are hired by our constituency and we are fired by the opponents or from the other political side, side of the political map. Meaning, if they don't like what I'm saying now, they can start a process and have 80 members of the Knesset suspending an Arab member, or it is not said an Arab member. This is the new thing. We have different laws that sounds like they are laws for everybody, but we know exactly against whom they will be used. But they don't say it very clearly. So this is another issue that can be used when you are talking about the Israeli democracy in this situation. I know that there are margins of democracy that are existing in Israel, and they are under attack by this same government. Netanyahu's government have targeted all the pillars of any democratic regime in any country. They are attacking the media. Either you be corrupted like the two cases that he is under investigation for corruption with media institutions, or you will be attacked and limited. He attacked the civil society with a new law for NGOs in Israel. He attacked the judiciary system. And you know, when we were discussing the new law of the public TV and public broadcasting, the minister of culture said very clearly why we need a public broadcast if we cannot control it. So this is the main idea. So this government is attacking all the pillars of any democratic regime, and I'm telling you, in the last 3 years, they managed to achieve a lot. We are hoping that in the next election, we will be able to get rid of this horrible, horrible government. Of course, that doesn't mean we will be the next government. That's very far. But at least those who will be in the government will face a real challenge of trying to rehabilitate or fix the things that happened in the last 3 years. Now, how is it to be the Arab teaching Arabic? That was one of the initiatives of different NGOs to kind express their solidarity with our struggle to preserve our language and against the law. This is the struggle against the law is going to take different activities and shapes. We are working on the international level, working in a, for example, we appeal, we send a complaint to the special rapporteur on rights of minorities about this law, and he decided to open an investigation against Israel for that law. I'm meeting through my visit here with the two vice general secretary of the United Nations to speak also about this. We are working on international level. On the internal level in Israel, we are going to have the parliamentarian work, but there will be a lot of initiatives, including this. There were thousands of people came to this open lesson for Arabic, how to teach Arabic. And that was really an act of solidarity and an act of a protest. How, where is the Netanyahu's government? He's exactly in good relationship with all that you mentioned. Hungary, he just, Prime Minister of Hungary or President of Hungary just visited Israel 2 weeks ago. He's in, Netanyahu's government is in good relation with Russia, with Putin. They are in, I think it's already 12 times that Netanyahu and Putin has met in the last 2 years or year and a half. This is an extraordinary number of meetings between two prime minister and president. So that exactly tell you Netanyahu's government, some people would like to say that as if Netanyahu is not an extremist, he has some extremists in his government. No. Netanyahu is leading this government and he is very much extreme to the right and he knows exactly what he is doing. He understood that it is the time to control the deep state in Israel. And he is shifting and changing the whole situation. How is it to be or strategy to support our struggle? I think by, first of all, revealing the facts, sharing the information, trying to influence, and the best support you can give us is changing the situation here. Working to change the situation and changing the big allies of Netanyahu and the good friend of Netanyahu, that will be a huge contribution to us. Of course, there is sharing information, trying to have these kinds of meetings, bringing the debate into the American society, that's also one of it. And you know what, I still have a little bit of feeling sad that on the same day that we were protesting in front of the new U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, we didn't see a huge demonstration here in the United States against that move. Sometimes you need to act at the same time we are acting so that, because I believe it contribute to your situation here and it contribute to our situation. How is it to be an Arab MK? It's wonderful. it's not easy. It's a big challenge, especially under this government, I have to say. I told you about the law. Maybe the suspension law is not meant to be used easily, especially after we appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court did a lot of limitations for using the suspension law. But the idea behind legislating this law was terrorizing the Palestinian Arab MKs. Be careful of what you are doing. Be careful of what you are representing, because this can be used against you any moment. The feeling is that you, the space where we can act is shrinking. And when you are standing on a piece of carpet, of rug that is shrinking, sometimes you feel you are losing your balance, and you have to keep reminding yourself why you are there. And I tell you, there's a huge debate today inside our community about, some people think that out of anger for this law, we should voluntarily suspend ourselves from the Knesset. And I'm telling, usually I'm reacting that when we got into the Knesset, and when I personally got into the Knesset, I didn't think that I'm going to have a lot of fun. And I understood that I will be facing a lot of troubles, and that it is huge difficulty to act inside the Knesset. But if you believe of what you are doing, and if you understand that there is a voice that should be heard, and you have the responsibility to represent and to protect your own people, then you have to continue. And it is not all very dark, you know. The fact that I'm chairing a committee, a statutory committee in the Knesset, gives me a lot of time challenges of cooperating with different members of different groups in the Israeli society on gender issues, and bringing a different discourse and dialogue into the political arena in Israel. And I think all of us are managing also to achieve an everyday rights and interests of our constituency. It's becoming more difficult, but we are managing to do it, and it is important. And if they want to get us out of the Knesset, they have to work very hard to. Why to make their life easy, Yani, to suspend ourselves? We're there to make troubles for them, and let them work very hard to get us out. And as you know, I left the Syrian issue toward the end of the answers. It's going to take 1 minute. We know very well from the first day how this Israeli government had its fingers very deep in Syria. And they claim that they are doing humanitarian aid. As I mentioned before, Israel is, for my regret, the Israeli government is serving the best interest of the United States of America in the region. And I think the Syrian issue is not out of that. They did a lot. How it is affecting internal situation, it's not an internal, yani it's not going to be reflected internally. What is happening in Syria, it's more a regional issue that is affecting. For the Israeli government, it was used an alibi, you say? Alibi. I used it in Hebrew now. An alibi for the last few years, saying, of course, look at what's happening in the Arab world. But at the same time, it was used to shift the attention from the main problem that is in stabilizing the Middle East, which is the continuous occupation, and creating the danger of Iran. And that affected also through the years and affected the decision of withdrawing from the nuclear agreement with Iran, etc., etc. It is more on a level of how the regional situation is benefited by Israel to continue the occupation. If there will be more stable situation, I think that will affect the regional policy of Israel and the situation in Palestine. It has also implications on the relations with the Arab world and how it is developing in Israel and splitting the region into two camps, one camp on the side of Syria, Iran, etc., and the other camp is with Arabia Saudi and the other countries, and Israel included in that camp. This is like very quickly in 2 minutes. Sorry. Thank you.
Before you all go, Bahman Azad wants to say a couple words about the U.S. Peace Council, and then just want to thank all of you for coming, and let's thank Ida once again for making this tour and speaking to so many people.
I brought up the issue of the international conference. In a sense, this what we've been discussing here is pretty much related to that conference, because in our view, Israel is in essence acting as a military base of the United States in the Middle East. And that's another issue that we have to consider. One thing I wanted to mention is that at that conference, Ida will be chairing our Middle East plenary. So if you want to hear more from her, I'm there. If you think it was a useful meeting, it was a helpful meeting organized by the U.S. Peace Council. We are more involved in this kind of activity, and I wanted to just close by inviting you to join us and lend your support to what we are doing and help us developing more of such events in New Jersey. And if you want to do that or you're interested, please contact Roger, talk to him. He's the chair of our New Jersey chapter, and he will help us. Thank you very much. The brochure is here if you want to pick it up.
Thank you for listening to this event. We co-sponsored this event with Jewish Voice for Peace and the U.S. Peace Council, amongst many other organizations. We were really proud to be a part of that coalition, and that's the kind of work we want to do more of here at New Jersey Revolution Radio. If you can chip in a little bit to help fund New Jersey Revolution Radio, and we can do more with your money like this event, like this educational experience that we all got to take part in, we'd like to do more of it. So please give a little bit of money if you can. www.njrevolutionradio.com. Click on Make a Contribution, and any amount helps. Thanks a lot, and have a nice night.